You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. On Monday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended pausing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, saying they were investigating unusual blood clots in six women who got the shot. One woman died. 7.2 million doses of the vaccine have been given here in the United States. That adds up to about 5% of America's vaccine program. Now, Johnson & Johnson delayed its planned rollout of the vaccine in Europe. And yesterday, the BBC interviewed Amish Aldager, an infectious disease specialist at Johns Hopkins, about the blood clots.
This is a very, very rare side effect that's occurring, even if it, and it hasn't even been established that it's related to the Johnson & Johnson. But even if you grant that, the risk-benefit calculation still favors the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Now, the pause is not a mandate. If doctors and patients feel the benefits outweigh any potential risk, they can still use that vaccine. But Aldager says the damage may already be done.
What I worry about is that the vaccine hesitancy will bleed from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and it's just going to make it that much harder, and it's already a hard job to get vaccines into people.
Also yesterday, St. Luke's Health System outlined what it's doing for people who were signed up to get the J&J vaccine tomorrow at their mass vaccination clinic in downtown Boise. So with us today to talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, as well as other aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic, are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Sky Blue, an infectious disease physician, as well as Scott Milner, St. Luke's Pharmacy Senior Director. I want to thank all of you for joining us today.
Thank you, Gemma.
Dr. Payne, can we start with you? Can you just give us a rundown of what we know so far in regards to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Well, what we have so far is we have a small number of people that have developed a highly unusual blood clot problem. It is something that we have seen before COVID, so this isn't entirely new, but it's rare. And the timing with the vaccine has caused regulators to say, hey, let's take a look at this to see if this is associated with the vaccine. I think we always have to be concerned when you're vaccinating tens or hundreds of millions of people, you're also going to see a lot of other conditions that happen anyway. So we want to be careful about making an association with the vaccine. But I'll say that certainly there is concern that this might be. However, if it is, it is very rare. And I think the committee is meeting today to look at the evidence to decide what to do, whether to pause it longer, whether to say, since this seems to happen in younger people, that will just restrict the use of the vaccine to certain groups, or whether this is so infrequent, it appears to be occurring less than one in a million people that get the vaccine, that we'll just make it a warning, but we can go ahead and resume using the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So Scott, can we talk about what St. Luke's is doing about the pause in the vaccine? Yesterday, during a news conference, you said St. Luke's has given out 807 doses of the J&J vaccine. So have you heard from anyone who received the vaccine who might be worried now about this possible side effect?
Yeah, great question. I know that yesterday morning, long even before we started our day, we had communications going around just after the 7 o'clock hour in the morning. And, what do we need to do to be nimble to make sure we respond appropriately and take that recommendation? And we told our state leaders and such. But right now we have seen, we did make the pivot for this week's clinic to, put in Moderna. We had enough inventory, and I'm sure that there are some people, as pointed out from the Johns Hopkins a minute ago, that there might be some vaccine hesitancy because there has been some preferential shopping for the Johnson & Johnson. But as of now, I haven't heard anything directly, although some of that information might take a little bit of time. you know, of anyone that's received a vaccine, most of our administrations of those 807 were well over 2 weeks ago. And so outside of that window where they've been identified as being at risk for this rare outcome. And so for the most part, the patients, again, we've put the J&J appropriately in hold and augmenting and encouraging the other two vaccines that are on the market.
So Scott, just to be clear, can we go back to the mass vaccination clinic that will happen tomorrow? So you will give out the Moderna vaccine, not the Johnson & Johnson. Do people have to do anything if they already, you know, are signed up for an appointment?
That's a great question. And we wanted to make this seamless for patients because I know historically there's been a lot of frustration in trying to get an appointment. So we transition patients automatically to hold their same appointment time. You know, we don't know what accommodations some of these patients may have had to get work off or other, you know, situations. So we're retaining their original appointment time and location and just supplementing, you know, to make sure that patients were aware of that. We also did send out a few venues for patients to be notified of that transition and allow them to opt out if they, you know, for whatever purpose that they might have. So the you know, previously scheduled Johnson & Johnson has been substituted for Moderna. We've been reaching out to patients to make sure they're aware of that and be able to answer any questions that might come. Mm-hmm.
What about, I know right now, I mean, with this, you know, voluntary pause that you're doing, as we know with Pfizer and Moderna, Scott, I mean, they have a limited shelf life. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a bit different, but are you concerned about the shelf life of Johnson & Johnson, depending upon how long this pause goes on for?
Not currently. I think the bigger indicator would be how long the pause goes on or what other outcomes. Again, we've heard that the experts are weighing in today. So I think we'll get a better idea, I'm hoping, before the conclusion of this week. So if this goes on for months, then yes, that will become a component. But I anticipate, you know, some sort of judgment to be passed and we can get better instruction before it expires.
Okay. Dr. Pate, can we go back to something that Scott brought up, which is this vaccine hesitancy? I think it's as we know, it's already there. I think something like this could potentially make it worse. But when we look at the numbers, first off, we know, according to the FDA, that about 7 million doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine have been given out so far. And we're talking about 6 cases. And I'm not trying to say that that doesn't matter, because it does. This is a potential side effect. But we also know that there are, so this is basically 1 in 1 million of this rare blood clot with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. When we look at oral contraceptives, Dr. Pate, there's about a 1 in 3,000 chance that a woman is going to have a blood clot. So can we talk a little bit about how concerned you believe people should be about this pause?
Yeah. You know, I don't think people should be concerned about this pause. I think they should see this as an evidence of the system working. You know, it's frankly, for many of us, it's quite amazing that with all the vaccinations taking place across the country, the 6 people getting a serious condition has already surfaced to the attention of the FDA, even though it's less than, as you pointed out, less than 1 in 1 million, the FDA is already all over this and looking at it. Some can argue that, well, you know, now the FDA is creating that fear. And certainly that may be the case for some. But on the other hand, I think people should be reassured that even something that appears to be very rare, we're taking it seriously, looking at it carefully, and that should be reassurance to people. Let me also make sure that people are not confused. You know, some people have hesitancy because they think the process was rushed last year to develop these vaccines, and I get that. But let me tell all the listeners that while certain administrative parts of this approval process were rushed, The clinical trials were not. The clinical trials were the same kind of trials that we've always done. And frankly, no clinical trial for approval of a medication, as you've just pointed out, like birth control pills, is designed to try to identify a complication that occurs in less than one in a million. We're looking at things that are common things in these trials, something that happens in one in 30 or 40,000 people. And we didn't see it. And the reason we didn't see it is because it's so rare. It's only once we started vaccinating tens of millions of people that we discovered it. So this is really a good sign. This shows that we're taking this the safety very seriously, and I think people should be reassured by this.
And Dr. Blue, what are your thoughts on this pause of the vaccine?
Sure. Thanks for asking. You know, the pause, and maybe even just to address the question, you know, brought up about hesitancy and what I'd say is confidence in vaccines and this process. You know, I think the pause was the right thing to do at this stage. And just to kind of reiterate a little bit about what is said, this is a type of a blood clot that is a little bit more severe than you know, a lot of the ones that we will see routinely in some of those other, you know, places you pointed out, such as in taking oral hormonal birth control pills and just in general process, we see lots of blood clots. The thing that, you know, getting back to the confidence, there's individuals who, you know, are very against vaccination in principle for a lot of reasons, and they're all going to look at this and just say, I told you so. And so I'm not really sure we would have changed their minds either way. From the other side, you know, I look at this, it isn't a win-lose, it isn't a gain on one side or another. This is how science works. We were able to identify, just like Dr. Pate says, you know, remarkably so, you know, a needle in a haystack, six cases out of nearly 7 million vaccinations, and coupled on the work that the EU has done with the AstraZeneca vaccine, looking at a similar sort of process. And so we're able to, because of that, say, hey, there might be something we can learn from this. And certainly it's the responsibility of those individuals who we put our trust in to say, hey, there's something we may be able to learn from this. Can we learn how to make it safer? Can we learn how to better direct the use of these vaccines? You know, let's let the individuals who've been vaccinated, you know, kind of get another week or two out and see if we're seeing more cases. Let's get full good numbers. So I look at this as a learning experience that was the right move. You know, whether we'll find out or we'll get recommendations today after this committee meeting, or whether we'll learn more about the science behind what's going on. Already, you know, is this like the AstraZeneca process? Because they have a head start on figuring out what's going on there. And that starts our hypothesis. And that's kind of what science does for that.
And Dr. Blue, you brought up a good point that these blood clots are different than other blood clots that you normally see. I read a report this morning that, in fact, the blood thinner that's normally given for blood clots may actually have adverse effects on this particular type of blood clot. Correct?
Correct. So a lot of speculation here because, you know, these six cases, they didn't occur in Idaho. I haven't seen them or had any information, and we're only getting, you know, real bare minimum of information from that. You know, speculating that it's somewhat similar to what we're seeing with the AstraZeneca vaccine, you know, suggests that this has something to do with platelets or the small cell-like material in our blood that helps our blood clot in the first place. And it is suspected to be similar to what happens with a blood thinner called heparin that causes antibodies to stick to platelets. So it's an issue both with clotting and overclotting. And the location of these clots being in the brain makes that more specific and difficult to treat. So, you know, I think it's very important that we understand the process here. Potential, how do we screen for it? How do we test for it? How do we identify it before it gets to the stage of being a life-threatening clot? And mm-hmm. is it the same as the AstraZeneca? Because we want to understand it so we know how to treat it appropriately as well.
So before we go and take a quick break, Scott, I know you have been kind enough to join us, but we are going to let you go after this. For folks who are just joining us right now, can we go over with the mass vaccination clinic tomorrow in downtown Boise, what's going on with that? Because the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been paused. That's what they were going to be given. But what can people expect tomorrow?
Yeah. So thank you. As the day unfolded, we wanted to make sure we honored the original appointment times and dates and accommodations that patients have made to, you know, commit to the appointment, respecting the pause recommendation from the CDC and then ultimately the other bodies across the United States. We determined to supplement or substitute in for a Moderna vaccine. So currently all the appointments that were made in anticipation of that vaccine clinic, they're being honored, they're being held and being offered a Moderna vaccine. And there are a number of patients who might have been preferential to Johnson & Johnson, and we are allowing those cancellations to occur and honoring those requests. But we are letting all of those patients have their appointment and a vaccine, a Moderna vaccine to be offered to them.
Well,
And I want to say, we have sent out multiple communications, and we're trying to make sure that patients are aware of that substitution so that they don't discover it just upon, you know, arriving for their vaccine.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you taking some time, Scott. I'm sure you are so busy right now. So thank you. We've been talking with Scott Milner. He is St. Luke's Pharmacy Senior Director. And I think it's important that we point out to our listeners that, you know, our doctors are here for general education and information for our listeners. I just want you to know that this program is not meant to take the place of medical care, folks. So if you need more information, you need to go to your doctor. The answers our doctors give are not specific medical advice. I mean, you have hopefully a doctor-patient relationship, and we just hope that if you have other questions that you talk with your regular doctor as well. So just, I think that's important that we clarify that as we continue to move through this. With that said, Dr. Pate, if someone has gotten the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and they are concerned about this possible side effect of these blood clots, what are the are there specific signs or symptoms that they should be looking for? And the time frame, right, is within 2 weeks of having been vaccinated.
Well, that's right, Gemma. So if someone has had that vaccine more than that period of time, you really don't need to be worrying about this. Of course, as you said, you know, if you do develop something unusual, I mean, there's plenty of other things to be in the mix. So do contact your doctor. But and frankly, with the way the Johnson & Johnson or Janssen vaccine has rolled out in Idaho, there's probably not too many Idahoans who have been vaccinated with that in just the past couple weeks. But if you were, you don't need to run into the emergency room. You don't need to run to your doctor. Just be aware. And again, keep in perspective, the chances of you developing a problem from that vaccine are like less than one in a million. So let's not get too carried away. What you want to be looking for, though, is something that is really out of the ordinary. For example, a very persistent and different kind of headache than you've had before, that one that will not go away, blurred vision. And I'm not talking about just a little something mild, something that is very significant. Abdominal pain, pain in your belly that is unusual and persistent, won't go away. Shortness of breath that is really pronounced, or a very serious pain in your leg. Those are the kinds of things. These are not going to be subtle symptoms. These are going to be symptoms that tell you, hey, something is not right. And if that's the case, then do contact your physician so that you can be evaluated.
And I would assume, Dr. Pate, with that, if you do go into an urgent care or an emergency room, let them know that you received this vaccine.
That's right. That's right. And also keep in mind, as Dr. Blue was talking about earlier, about that we can't treat this the same way that we treat the routine kinds of blood clots that we see. We do have treatments for this. So there's other ways that we can manage this. But your advice is good, Gemma. Be sure to let them know about your vaccination status.
You know, Dr. Blue, we have now passed, you know, a year mark. In fact, we're going on 13 months of the first coronavirus-related death here in Idaho. And yesterday, we passed the 2,000 mark of COVID-related deaths here in our state. So that makes our fatality rate at about 1.09%. You know, I know a lot of folks have COVID fatigue, right? And we might tend to think, well, this is, you know, this is over. Can you talk about the fact that, you know, we are still in this, and when we hit a mark like that, I would think that a 1% fatality rate is not insignificant.
Yeah, I certainly could. Let me just finish up with something Dr. Pate was saying and reemphasize.
Sure.
Is that if you've gotten a vaccination, most of the side effects like headaches and things like that we see after a vaccine happen in the first 3 days. You know, the time frame of these other side effects that we're talking about as being 6 to 14 days. So if you either have symptoms that persist beyond 3 days or new symptoms that start after 6 or 7 days, that's something to get checked out. And so that's the time frame I think a lot of people can look at, that this is different than the usual side effects you get after a vaccine. So I hope that clears that up a little bit.
And that does. Yeah, I appreciate that. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you.
No. So looking at, you know, fatality rate, and we certainly are still in this. And I've had calls today about individuals who are hospitalized and with severe COVID. So it is continuing to happen. And just hate to see it, you know, when vaccines are getting into people's arms, that there's availability and where we are, that we're still seeing individuals get sick and potentially die. So a mention about the fatality rate, and so there's, you know, differences between what we call the infection fatality rate and the case fatality rate. And, you know, there's a lot said about only a 1% case fatality rate, but that still adds up this year to 2,000 Idahoans. And that's certainly right. More than we've seen for a lot of things. That almost, you know, is getting close to the World Trade Center, you know, death. And so it's important. And a single death that's preventable will, you know, should make us all sad. So, you know, I think, you know, sometimes we'll say, well, it's only individuals with other medical problems or they're old. That's not the case. And we're, and even with medical problems, dying from something that's preventable should give us pause.
Mm-hmm. And then we are, I believe just earlier this week, two COVID-19 variants were confirmed by a laboratory in Twin Falls County. South Central Public Health District announced this. So now officially in Twin Falls County, they've got the California variant. They've got the UK variant. As we know, the UK variant is now the most common variant strain in the United States. And Dr. Pate, you've been talking about this, that we're going to see these new variants. And as Dr. Blue just mentioned, what we're starting to see in certain parts of the country is that younger people are now not just getting COVID, but being hospitalized.
Well, Gemma, you're exactly right. And it's been, I think, a bit frustrating. As you're right, I've been sounding this alarm since late January, beginning February, that, you know, we can't just take our experience with the prior form of the virus that we've been dealing with for the past year and say that's exactly how it's going to be with the UK variant. Because frankly, if you observe Europe and now Canada and now some of the United States, you see that it doesn't act the same way, and it is more transmissible, and there's mounting evidence that it causes more severe disease. And when I talk to my colleagues in the Upper East Coast, what they say is that going to the hospitals is different now. What they see is a lot sicker 20, 30, 40, 50 year olds. And in fact, they've been reporting a many fold increase in the numbers of people in those age groups getting infections. Now, part of that makes sense if we're vaccinating our seniors and giving them right. priority, then you do expect to see younger people. But what you would expect to see is the same relative numbers of younger people in hospitals. And what is being reported out of Europe, Canada, and now these United States is that, no, those numbers are significantly increased. So, you know, it's just a matter. I mean, I don't say that to scare anybody. That's not the purpose. The purpose of saying this is it's not over. We still need to take precautions, and we're getting there. We just haven't gotten enough people vaccinated yet. I hope we'll be there in a couple months. But, you know, what would be a terrible shame is to get this far and then have people get infected because they let their guard down when they are days or weeks away from getting vaccinated, and then something bad happens to them. And I just want to add on to what Dr. Blue said, you know, when he was addressing the fatality rate, that it's not insignificant. But the other thing is that when we talk about fatality rates, that doesn't include what he and I would refer to as morbidity, things that don't kill you, but do make your life miserable and cause symptoms. And so we have to keep in mind that there are some people that get COVID and have other long-lasting problems, even though they survive. So it's not a matter of letting free at this point. We still need to keep our guard up.
Dr. Blue, John in Boise wants to know, what happens if someone gets multiple vaccines? He does go on to say, with vaccine tracking, I know this is unlikely that you'd get a double dose, but what would happen?
So the short answer is we don't know, because this hasn't been studied in any systematic way. However, there are some things that we can extrapolate and speculate on. And in fact, they have even tried this in a mice experiment. And so just to get back to the vaccines itself, most of these vaccines are utilizing what we call the spike protein. So they're similar, but how they utilize that spike protein is a little bit different for each vaccine. The two vaccines we've been talking about, the Pfizer and the Moderna, use something called the mRNA, which is a temporary message so that our body produces the spike. The Johnson & Johnson Janssen vaccine, as well as AstraZeneca, use another model to get the template in for the spike through an adenovirus vector. So at the end of the day, what we're submitting to the immune system is the spike protein. So there's a good chance that mixing or matching vaccines will give us the same boosting effect that we see by using the a similar vaccine as prescribed. That said, we haven't studied it directly, and nobody is recommending that. In a pinch, it could be something we could turn to. So we hope that they would act similarly. And we're also noticing that individuals who've had COVID before and then get a vaccine don't not only get a better level of immunity, but that initial infection might act as a first shot, and the first vaccination actually act as a booster. So we're learning more and more as these natural experiments happen. So you could probably get by with mixing them, but we're not recommending that. And certainly, as you mentioned, we take a lot of steps to make sure that doesn't happen for you.
Dr. Pate, you know, there's a lot of misinformation, but also disinformation out there. And that's why I want you to address this question from Joe in Ketchum, because they asked, do the vaccinations affect our DNA at all?
They do not. So, you know, for maybe for people to visualize this, think about a cell in your body like a chicken egg. And if you open that egg, you've got the yellow yolk. That's for a cell, that's the nucleus. And that's where your DNA is. And then the white part of the egg is what we would refer to as the cytoplasm of the cell. That's where the messenger RNA from the vaccines that Dr. Blue is talking about do their work. And so those vaccines don't even get into the nucleus where the DNA is. Mm. And so they do not alter your DNA. Plus, RNA that you get in these vaccines is very short-lived. It's not very stable. In fact, that's why we've all heard about these very extraordinary steps we have to take in the cold chain to keep that vaccine stable, because the messenger RNA is not very sturdy.
And what about fertility? Joe in Ketchum wants to know about that as well.
Yeah, that has not proved out to be an issue. It was started by a couple of anti-vaxxers in Europe that wrote to one of the European health agencies and suggested that the vaccines would affect a protein that is involved in fertility, but they do not. And so that has been debunked. And people need not worry about infertility, and they need not worry about the vaccine having any kind of alteration of their DNA.
Dr. Blue, another listener wonders your thoughts on Pfizer asking for emergency usage of the Pfizer vaccine in 12 to 15-year-olds. And they go on to ask, is there a chance that Idaho children, at least down to 12 years old, could be vaccinated before the school year begins in the fall?
Yeah, so I was very excited about that. And I've been following the data from the clinical trials that have been going down to age 12. And they seem as good, or if not better, than the response we see in adults. There isn't anything biologically that we suspect would act differently in this age group. So anticipate that they will be able to submit that to the FDA, and the FDA, you know, acting after advisory, you know, committee meets, to potentially approve that all the way down to age 12. And then soon as that happens, the doses that are in Idaho may be able to be redirected as well to that age group. The timing of which is only speculation, but I think that they will, move on that rather quickly, in knowing that the school year is upon us, and trying to get that done before summer is out.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Pate, with that being said, I would think that Idaho is in a fairly decent place for that, since we've opened up our vaccines for all age groups right now. When this, if this gets approval, would it then potentially roll out fairly quickly to this younger age group?
Yes, I think like Dr. Blue, I'm very excited about this, and I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be able to vaccinate children before the school year. I think the real issue is when we talk about vaccine hesitancy, a lot of those are parents of these children, and they can't get the vaccine without parental consent. So, and I suspect a lot of parents are going to think, wait, why am I going to get my kid vaccinated? Because kids don't get very sick. Well, first of all, some kids do. But second of all, kids play a very important role in the transmission of this virus, more so with the UK variant. And so I think for all those parents that want to get school back towards normal, I think this is our best opportunity. So I think two things. One, we're going to need parents to get these kids vaccinated. And second, it's probably going to be over the summer. So we got to find ways to get that message out and get people mm-hmm. with their busy summers and all their activities, make sure they still get their kids vaccinated.
Dr. Pate, one listener has a question in regard to parents with children in the home, asking, even if parents are vaccinated, should they still be acting as if they have not been vaccinated if their children are not eligible to be vaccinated yet?
Well, I think if the parents are vaccinated, right now we're not seeing a lot of activity from the variants that we have concerns about how effective the vaccine is. The UK variant is the one that's most dominant, and then the next one is the California one. And both of those, we think we have really good protection from the vaccine. So I would say for parents here in Idaho, no, they don't need to take any special precautions with their own children. But we do need to still take precautions when we're outside of our own family and we don't know about people's immunization status.
Dr. Blue, another listener writes in about boosters, saying it seems like a real expectation that once vaccinated, we'll need to get boosters. Do we know or have any research yet about booster frequency? And then they go on to ask, and this might be tied back, Dr. Blue, to what you said earlier, will they forever be tied to the particular vaccine that they first received? For example, if you had the Moderna vaccine, do you always have to get the Moderna booster?
Sure. So again, it's fun to speculate on this because we have not been going long enough to really know the answer to that. However, the manufacturers of these vaccines have continued to test the earliest participants in their clinical trials. And we've had a report out now that at least 6 months post-vaccination, we still have very good levels of circulating immunity. And so that's only one marker of immunity. We have other arms of the immune system and called T-cell immunity that can also persist even when antibody levels in the bloodstream start to decline. So what we need to know, and that we don't know yet, is any level of immunity going to be enough to prevent us from getting the severe COVID-19 disease, the long COVID, or the other side conditions that we want to prevent. And then there may be a different level that helps reduce the more mild disease or transmission in the community. So the answer is we don't know, but at least through 6 months, we have good persistence of that immunity. The other thing that may require us to get a type of booster is if that one of these variants tends to looks like it's going to escape our current immunity, we may come up with a booster that gives an additional type of virus in there that might protect us from one or more of the new variants. And that may be a reason that we come to the public with another vaccine or a booster. So we will know these as time goes on, and we'll continue to measure. And so certainly we'll get good heads up if we're going to have to get to that stage.
Dr. Pate, Mariah writes in. She says, I'm 45, very healthy. I'm fully vaccinated. I had no reaction to either shot. From everything I hear, reactions are a sign that one, the vaccine is working, and two, your immune system is mounting a strong response. So I'm curious, given I didn't have any reactions, should I be concerned that my immune system is not as strong as I thought it was?
No. And so she is right. Certainly when we see people having these reactions, and Dr. Blue commented about, we typically see these symptoms in the first couple of days after vaccine, that is your immune system reacting. However, the converse is not true. If you are not having symptoms, that does not mean that your immune system is not working. In fact, we know from the studies that most people did not have very pronounced symptoms, and some had none at all. And yet almost everybody mounted a very, very good immune response. So I would tell her that she does not need to worry.
Which is good advice. I want to thank both of you for taking time today to talk to us about this and to also get us updated on where we are in Idaho with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. If you joined us after we spoke with Scott Milner, the pharmacist at St. Luke's, about tomorrow's mass vaccination clinic, if you are scheduled for that, you still have your appointment. They are giving the Moderna vaccine, not the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. If you prefer not to have the Moderna vaccine, you can cancel your appointment. But information for you to know if you are scheduled for that. Our thanks to Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, and Dr. Sky Blue, an infectious disease physician. Thank you both. Really appreciate all of your knowledge and your expertise.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Gemma. And just a quick word, Gemma, state of Idaho owes Dr. Blue a tremendous debt of gratitude. He has spent so much of his time educating physicians across the state about COVID, and I just want to extend that appreciation to him.
Yeah, Dr. Blue, I would second that, absolutely. I want to thank both of you again. Thank all of our frontline workers for everything you've been doing, because this is still going on. And a big thank you to our listeners. We so appreciate you and appreciate your engagement with us. If you have questions for our medical experts, they will be back next week. So get those questions in, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Our producers for Idaho Matters are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow.